This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Our TV critic David Bianculli is with us with his picks of the best and worst TV shows of the year. We're also going to look back on some of the biggest developments in cable and broadcast this year. David was the longtime TV critic for the New York Daily News. He now writes the online magazine TVWorthWatching.com, teaches TV and film at Rowan University, and is the author of a new book about the Smothers Brothers called Dangerously Funny. Well, hi, David. Happy holidays. And
hi,
happy
hi.
New Year.
You too. Happy to be back.
So much has happened on TV and behind the scenes of TV this year. So when you look at the landscape, what do you think is the biggest TV story of the year?
Well, last year, the biggest story was the strike and the repercussions. This year, the biggest story is Jay Leno. He transformed late night, put all these dominoes in play, and then showed up in primetime and gobbled up five nights of CBS's TV time, and then didn't do well.
Didn't do well in what sense?
First of all, he didn't do a good show. It's an almost, to me, unwatchable show, and it's not as entertaining as even The Tonight Show was. But in what it had to do, which was to make money because it cost so much less than a drama for NBC to put in the 10 p.m. slot, that it's accomplished only barely. And in giving any sort of a lead-in to the local affiliates for their newscasts, which is very important, it's really failing. So I expect an all-out mutiny next year.
What would a mutiny mean?
It would mean that local affiliates that are aligned with NBC could say, you know, I could take a syndicated program or put a local program or move something else in there in that last hour and garner a bigger audience for my local news, which is where most of my money comes from. So I'll just delay showing Jay Leno until 11:30, and then I'll move The Tonight Show back to 12:30, and I'll move, you know, Jimmy Fallon back to, you know, the Farm Film Report.
So can you compare the ratings of the NBC shows that had been on in the 10 o'clock spot with what Leno is getting now?
It varies night to night, but it's, you know, a 20% drop, 30% drop, 50% drop. It's substantial. And it's also substantial in terms of the young demos that they find so attractive. NBC is trying to put a good face on this, but there's not much of a good face. And now that one of the big stories to end the year is NBC, you know, being sort of absorbed by Comcast with new owners in charge, they're probably not going to be so enamored with the idea of staying with this.
So you think they might just pull the show?
Well, even Jay Leno has said, you know, I wouldn't mind going back to my old slot at Tonight.
Which, whoa.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, isn't that a big—
Tell that to Conan O'Brien.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. That is such a big whoa. And, you know, if you thought that his leaving The Tonight Show and then sort of bringing it to primetime under another name was a little bit disingenuous or not being a team player, what about that admission?
So this year, late night changed a lot. Mm-hmm. You know, Leno moved from The Tonight Show to the new 10 o'clock show. Run through the musical chairs that have happened at late night.
Well, let's see. Conan moved up to Tonight. Jimmy Fallon took his place at late night. And at the other networks, things remained stable. You had Nightline on ABC. You have Letterman on CBS and then Craig Ferguson on after him. But what this new shift meant is that Conan had to sort of temper his act a little bit in order to appeal to a wider audience. And he got a younger demo. The age for The Tonight Show has dropped by about 10 years, the average age. But unfortunately, the overall audience has dropped so significantly that Letterman is now winning over The Tonight Show. And it didn't used to be. And in the 12:30 slot, Ferguson is beating Fallon, and that didn't even used to be a close race. So there's a shift.
There were two major things that I think helped give Letterman a big audience this year. One of them was the feud with Sarah Palin,
mm-hmm.
and the other was his affair, which he handled in such an interesting way, and he was so funny about it. No matter what you think of his affair, I think you have to say he made better jokes about it than anybody else did.
Well, he not only made better jokes, and you're absolutely right, but he not only made better jokes about it, but he confronted it head on. And you can not like what he did and still like the way that he handled it. It's sort of like Richard Nixon, this is the way you should have handled Watergate. Tiger Woods, you know, take note. You know, it was just a straight on, look, I don't want to tell you this, but here's exactly what's going on. And it was out there. There wasn't a second day story because he told it all the first day.
We're talking about the year in television with Fresh Air's TV critic, David Bianculli. David, when we do these year-end wrap-ups, we don't usually talk about soap operas, but we're going to talk about them now because there's significant change in the world of soap operas. What's left?
Very little. And the really tenured ones, you know, are going away. Guiding Light left, and next year we're going to get As the World Turns. I mean, and these are
– As the World Turns is ending next year?
Yes. And these are CBS soaps that were around as long as television was around and before that on radio. And it's actually something that's generational. There aren't that many shows left from the salad days of television. There's Meet the Press, and there really isn't much else except for soaps. Now, you can look at it and say – in the last 10, 20 years, primetime has absorbed the idea of the soap. So you get plenty of soap opera stuff if you're watching Brothers and Sisters or even a serialized, you know, story genre thing like Lost. But the idea of having something to watch every afternoon and or every morning and just do it the way it was done for generations, TV is saying, well, that's not important either right now.
So what is on during the day?
Who knows? You know, I'm sure. I'm working. I have the sound off. There's people still angry about stuff. There's game shows and there's lots of talk. And it astounds me. Jerry Springer is still on.
And Oprah's leaving for broadcast. That's a big story.
Yes, that is a big story.
Speaking of the afternoons.
That's like, is God dead? No, but Oprah's leaving TV. You know, it's a close second. You know, how are we going to find out what books to read? But I think we'll survive. But, you know, and I think that Oprah will not go far. Oprah will not pull a Johnny Carson and leave after 30 years.
Well, she's starting her own cable network.
Yes, yes. You know, and if her magazine doesn't work, she'll just start her own. Well, she can't start her own newspaper. She's not that stupid. There's no newspaper, you know. There's something out there that she'll do.
The big business story of the year is probably NBC merging with Comcast, which is happening this month. Comcast bought a 51% share of NBC. What impact do you think that will have on the network and on us, the viewers of the network?
I honestly don't know. There's two ways to look at it. You could think of it as a good thing because the cable arm of NBC Universal is doing better programming than the network broadcast arm. So
you're talking about MSNBC?
I'm talking about like Universal, like USA Network, some of those programs.
Oh, I see.
So some of the things that have come to us on the Sci-Fi Channel and other things that are part of the whole network synergy umbrella, that if they bring some of those programs to network TV would be better served. But on the other hand, they don't necessarily – I don't trust executives to do the right thing. The right thing would be to do the cable model and do – instead of 22 episodes a year, maybe do 10 or 12 like cable does. Do better shows and cycle them off. But I think we may just get more and more reality shows and trim the profits and, you know, sell their own fare from NBC to their own sister things to keep it in the family. It's, you know, the money for making these shows is getting harder and harder to find.
Last year, one of the big TV stories was the political coverage of the election. And the really divisive campaign.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the first year of President Obama's presidency. How do you think political coverage on television changed this year?
It became less dynamic. I think that one of the things that you could see is that almost all of the networks, rather than favor Obama, went to look at him critically fairly early. I don't mean critical in a bad sense, but I mean there wasn't a honeymoon period that lasted too long. Maybe that was just because of current events and everything that was happening so quickly. When I compare like Fox News, for example, and MSNBC, I find them, you know, equally shrill when they engage one another. It's still like children in a sandbox on both sides. But I do think that there's a difference in content.
Okay, let's look at the best and worst of the year, starting with the worst. What do you think were the worst TV shows of the year?
The worst in terms of most important worst?
Yes.
I would say Jay Leno, because the failure of that show, both in terms of the ratings and creatively, are going to have a major impact on TV for the next couple of years. But I will say I think it would have been worse if it had been a better show, worse for television if it had succeeded.
Because?
Because then we'd have 10 of shows just like that gobbling up all the hours of prime time.
Okay. What about the best TV shows of 2009?
All right. I like the fact that it's really hard to come up with a top 10, not because there aren't 10, but because there are more. So here first off are ones that just missed my top 10. Rescue Me on FX, In Treatment on HBO, Glee on Fox, House on Fox, Modern Family on ABC, Battlestar Galactica on Sci-Fi, and Fringe on Fox. Those are all wonderful shows. But now I'm going to tell you more wonderful. My number one show for this year was Curb Your Enthusiasm on HBO. I thought the whole Seinfeld story was brilliant and brilliantly resolved. Mad Men on AMC. I love that when I watch that show, it seems to be of a different pace than anything on television and operating at a more interesting frequency. And like what I like about Larry David's Curb Your Enthusiasm, even when you know what's coming, it surprises you. And I love that. The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, I think even in a non-political year, managed to be both very important and very funny. I'm amazed at how much energy those guys have. And really, he's the best TV critic working in the United States right now. I know he doesn't want that title and probably wouldn't accept it, but he's doing more about deconstructing the media than anybody else.
Is Colbert on your list?
Colbert would be actually one more rung down. I should have mentioned Colbert, but he's not on my top 10. But it's only because Colbert, whom I also love, I think is more of an act, and Jon Stewart, who says he's an act, to me is more serious. I think he's playing with higher stakes. I do like them both. Lost on ABC is going to be ending next year, and it hasn't been around for a while, so you have to have a good memory to put it on a top 10 list. But I like the idea of looking forward to a TV show and trying to figure it out, but not so hard that it becomes obsessive. I really have like the whole journey of Lost, so I still like that. So now, and then Friday Night Lights, which used to be on NBC, and it still is, but NBC has sort of shared costs by lending it out. So DirecTV Network, a satellite firm gets to show it first. So I'm watching it on satellite each Wednesday now and loving it, and it'll show up on NBC next year. It's NBC's best show, and NBC doesn't even care enough about it to pay whatever it would take to show it first. That, to me, says where NBC is. 30 Rock, at least NBC shows. I love the humor on that. Showtime's Dexter was so twisted this year. John Lithgow as a villain, every bit as watchable as Michael C. Hall as the twisted serial killer hero. Great show. Breaking Bad is another twisted show that was on AMC, and it got a lot of attention for its acting, but not necessarily for its writing. But I think the writing on that is brilliant. And then we've got three more. True Blood on HBO, which is my idea of just a bloody summer book. You know, I can't – it's just so much fun. Damages on FX I think is one of the best legal procedurals on TV ever. And finally, this one will surprise you, I think, 60 Minutes on CBS. I think it's had another superb year. And you talk about shows that have been around for a long time. 60 Minutes started in 68. So 41 years later, it's still in the top 10, still doing better TV journalism than just about than anything else. I won't qualify it on broadcast TV.
Okay. Anything else you want to say about the year in television? It sounds like you're pretty enthusiastic about
it. I'm enthusiastic.
In spite of all the problems that television is having.
Yeah, but the trend that I see, and this I'm sad about,
yes,
is that more of the good shows, more of the really good things are being done on cable rather than on broadcast. And I think it's just one more thing that broadcast TV is abdicating. They gave up the TV movie. They gave up the miniseries. And now if they're giving up comedies and dramas, you know, if the best ones are on cable rather than on broadcast, then what are you in the business for? It baffles me and saddens me a little bit. And the other thing is that as broadcast TV, the overall audience dwindles, nothing's going to replace that. We're not going to have another shared national experience once we lose TV.
Yeah, well, I think it's impossible now anyways because there's so many channels and you have the internet and you have all these other portable devices from smartphones, iPods. We're done.
It was nice being here.
In terms of being united by pop culture, I think things are just so fragmented now, for better and for worse.
I know. Thank goodness for American Idol.
Which we didn't mention.
I know. And it's okay. I mean, it is the last thing that sort of pulls people into the living room as a family the way television used to. And it is the most popular show on TV. The fact that we didn't mention it means it's hugely popular. It's not hard to defend as a viewing experience, but it's not, to me, meaningful. Meaningful to me is a TV series I want to own on DVD and watch again. Doesn't matter how many people saw it the first time. You know, if I want to go back to The Wire, you know, The Wire's gone. Deadwood is gone. I love watching those shows. I'm never, ever, ever going back to an American Idol, you know, to see Sanjaya's hair one more time. It's just not going to happen.
Well, David, thanks for managing to sneak The Wire into our discussion, even though it wasn't even on the air this year.
No, it's all right. But still, you know, you talk about best show of the decade. That's probably it.
Yeah. So do you think in some ways, instead of like the big mass shared experience of television, what we're having now is sharing experiences? We send clips to friends that we found on YouTube. We get clips from friends. And so we see these like high points of various things that happened in TV and on the world.
That's the best way I've ever heard it described, sharing experience instead of shared. I'm very excited.
Let's credit our producer, Phyllis Myers, who came up with that during our interview and talked to us in the headphones.
But it's really what has happened. And it's hard for me to accept it. Let's say, for example, something big happens, but nobody watches it on TV. But it starts getting viral on the internet, and where maybe it only originally had an audience of 1 or 2 million, whether it's something that Jon Stewart did or it's a musical performance by Susan Boyle or anybody else. And then all of a sudden it gets 10, 15 million hits over the internet. But still what happens right now is that it gets then vindicated when one of the morning shows or one of the evening shows comes back and says, oh, look at this popular thing on the internet, and sort of crowns it. So right now it does go back to TV, but I don't know how much longer it's going to. But I don't know if taking 2 minutes out of a monologue and having that shared because everybody wants to see it is the same thing as watching the entire hour of like the Johnny Carson show 10 years ago. I think it's different somehow.
David, it was great to talk with you. Thank you for putting together your list for us. And those lists will be on our website, so you can find them there at freshair.npr.org. David, happy new year. Happy holidays. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you.
David Bianculli is Fresh Air's TV critic. He also writes the web magazine TVWorthWatching.com. He teaches TV and film at Rowan University and is the author of a new book about the Smothers Brothers called Dangerously Funny. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the new book, Good Without God, my guest Greg Epstein writes that the fastest-growing religious preference in America is non-religious. In his job as Harvard University's humanist chaplain, Epstein works with non-religious students. He describes the humanist community as a place where family, memory, ethical values, and the uplifting of the human spirit can come together with intellectual honesty and without a God. Today is a humanist holiday called Human Light, a secular alternative to the religious holidays of the season. It was created in 2001. Greg Epstein is a humanist rabbi. He has his M.A. in theological studies from the Harvard Divinity School. He wrote his new book in response to people who ask, how can you be good without God? Greg Epstein, welcome to Fresh Air. So today is a humanist holiday, December 23rd, called Human Light. Are you celebrating that? Do you recognize that holiday?
Yes, I recognize Human Light as one of the holidays that humanists celebrate at this time of year. I've written about it in the book. But I also think that there are many ways to celebrate this time of year, including celebrating the traditionally religious holidays from a cultural point of view. So in other words, I think that most humanists and atheists that are of a Christian cultural background like to celebrate Christmas from a Christian cultural point of view. Most humanists and atheists of a Jewish cultural background enjoy something about Hanukkah and about that tradition, but from a cultural point of view instead of viewing it as something about God and religion.
Can we mention that probably a lot of Jews give Christmas gifts too?
Yeah, because I think that you know, the America is a profoundly culturally Christian country in a way that it is not religiously Christian. And so it's not such a terrible thing or something that we need to run away from that our calendar and a lot of our national consciousness follows the rhythm of the traditionally Christian calendar. The positive part of that for me is that a lot of customs that have come from one or another aspect of Christianity have really been made very cultural and very secular and even very humanist in recent generations. And so to me, you know, the idea of Christmas, of giving gifts, it really has very, very, very little to do, other than that little story about Jesus and him receiving gifts. It really has very little to do with the theology of Jesus Christ, or even a theology about a God. What it has to do with, to me, is this idea that this is the time of year when it's darkest. This is the time of year for us here in North America when it's coldest. And seasonal affective disorder, SAD, is real. And we do. We get a little sadder. We get a little bit more depressed at this time of year if we're not careful. And so we give gifts to one another to warm each other up. And I think that that's a wonderful thing to do and a very secular thing to do.
Let's talk a little bit about what you mean when you describe yourself as a humanist. Mm-hmm. In your book, you say humanism is a bold, resolute response to the fact that being a human being is lonely and frightening. And humanism means taking charge of the often lousy world around us and working to shape it into a better place, though we know we cannot ever finish the task. Can you talk a little bit more about what humanism means to you?
Well, humanism to me, it's been formally defined by the American Humanist Association, and it's a short definition that I think is helpful, a progressive life stance or a progressive philosophy of life that, without supernaturalism, without anything magical or supernatural, affirms our ability and our responsibility to lead ethical lives of personal fulfillment, aspiring to the greater good of humanity. But in short, I would say that humanism is good without God. It is that struggle, that process of trying to live the best life that we possibly can for ourselves and for all human beings and for the sake of the natural world that surrounds us and that sustains us and that we've put in danger, that's good without God. That's humanism. But I guess I would also add to that the emphasis for me of humanism is not on the without God. It's not on what we disbelieve in. Everybody has something that they disbelieve in. You know, Christians disbelieve in Islam. Muslims disbelieve in Christianity. But to me, the emphasis of humanism is really on what we do believe. It's on the good and our pursuit of the good and our determination to be good with others and for others.
Let's talk about how you became a humanist, because you were really on your way to becoming more of a religion scholar, I think it's fair to say, but I'll ask you specifically about that a little later. But let's start with the fact that you grew up in New York in Flushing, Queens. You describe your parents as secular, disinterested Jews. Did they observe the High Holy Days? Because there's a lot of like secular Jews who on Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah will observe.
We did. We went to our local synagogue for those particular days because I think that, like other families, we were looking for some way to connect with what was clearly our heritage, what was clearly our culture. And it seemed that these were the days that were well known to be the most important days on the calendar. And so it was the sense that, well, at least we should go these days. Everybody's going these days. And nobody, quite frankly, or at least very few people, would go any other days besides those. And so we would show up in synagogue on those particular days, and not really knowing what to do. And when I would get there, I would observe the people around me, and they'd be cracking open these sort of musty older prayer books. And they would be reciting, at the very best, words that just seemed to be recited by rote. Baruch atah Adonai, blessed are you, O Lord, our God. But it didn't really seem to me to be a group of people truly interested in blessing the Lord, their God. It seemed to me that if that was what these people really believed, their behavior would be different.
So when you discovered humanistic Judaism, is that when you went back and got your master's in Judaic studies?
So I did. I enrolled in the rabbinic program. Sherwin Wine was somebody who came from being a Reform rabbi in the 1960s. He was a brilliant young Reform rabbi who was leading a congregation. And like many rabbis, he'd gone to rabbinical school with the open understanding between him and his faculty that he was a humanist. He said, I'm not religious, but I like working with communities. I like my culture. I like my heritage. So I want to work at doing this job. And they said, sure, fine, no problem. Half of our students are. And this is Hebrew Union College, still the largest rabbinical seminary in the country. But after several years of doing this, he decided that he just didn't want anymore to say prayers that he didn't believe. He didn't want to get up in front of his congregation and have it be about a performance. He really wanted to speak more honestly to them. And so he created a movement where one could celebrate one's cultural background, in his case, Judaism, while combining that with a totally honest, raw, brave form of humanism that was uncompromising intellectually.
The word dignity was very important to your mentor, Sherwin Wine. What did dignity mean to him?
I think that Sherwin was interested in pursuing, and I, in turn, am really passionate about pursuing a sense of purpose, a sense of meaning in life that is not bound by or determined by a belief in a higher power that assigns us. We acknowledge as humanists that there is no one single overarching purpose or meaning to our lives that's given to us, that's handed to us by the universe. But Sherwin was very much aware in the tradition of Camus and many others that we therefore have not just the freedom but also the responsibility to choose a meaning for our own lives and to struggle to pursue it. And, he simply asked these questions. Well, what is the meaning of our life? What is the purpose of our life if not, avoiding divine punishment or achieving divine reward? And he called it dignity. It's this idea that we're never going to be happy all the time. I mean, the writer Tony Kushner once said that he's never met anyone who's perfectly happy all the time. The best you can do is happy-ish. But Sherwin and I would probably argue as well that happy-ish can be pretty good if combined with a sense of dignity, a sense that one is, and in this I would use again a saying that comes from religion but that has nothing to do with God, that one is for oneself, because if we're not for ourselves, who will be for us? But we are also for others, because if we're only for ourselves, what are we? And if not now, when? That's dignity to me, that sense that we build our lives and the meaning of our lives based on the relationships, the connections that we have with other people in the here and now.
So getting back to the idea of humanistic Judaism, you say you've preserved some of the aspects of Judaism.
Mm-hmm.
So do you do anything on Yom Kippur, which is one of the high holy days? It's a day of like atonement and fasting.
Sure. Yes. For me personally, I did fast for 24 hours, 25, 26 hours this past Yom Kippur as a way of reflecting on the meaning of my own life and on what kind of person I'd been in the year that had passed. I think that to me, again, it's this idea that religion had its good ideas and its bad ideas, and they've all evolved naturally. And one of the ideas that I think is helpful is to take some time throughout the year, throughout our lives on a regular basis to check in with ourselves and say, how are we doing? How am I doing? How am I living? How am I handling my relationships with the people that I care most about? How am I handling my relationship with this earth that I live on, that I can't do without? And, you know, these are ideas that don't come from religion. You don't need religion to have them. But religion is the thing in today's society that seems to embody or provide a structure for some of these things, because that's the way that they evolved. They came to us through religious traditions because everything about human society used to be religious when we didn't have better answers for some of religion's questions.
Your humanist mentor, Sherwin Wine, said that the mistake of the Jewish Reform Movement mm-hmm. was to translate the prayers, the Hebrew prayers, from Hebrew to English. And he said once modern people could actually understand what they were supposed to be saying, big mistake. And so I want to talk with you a little bit about the mourner's prayer for the dead, the Kaddish. Mm-hmm. It's called Kaddish. And
sure.
I don't speak Hebrew, so I can't translate it word for word, but just listening to the sounds of the words in Hebrew and the
yes.
way that those sounds are chanted, I think it is mm-hmm. one of the most beautiful prayers I've ever heard. And it is one of the most rhythmic prayers
yes.
that I know, and almost really contemporary in its rhythm, too, and in the musicality of that rhythm.
Timeless, in fact.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I always wonder, well, what is it saying? What does it mean?
Mm-hmm.
Because you kind of give it your own meaning when you don't really know the literal translation.
Sure.
So I thought I'd read a translation, unless you can translate it. Could you just translate what the words are?
Well, I would say that Yitkadal v'Yitkadash Shemei Rabbah, may it be magnified and sanctified, his great name, God's great name. And that's exactly what the Mourner's Kaddish is about. It's such a beautiful composition, and based on my study of the Hebrew liturgy, and I had a chance in my studies to study many different forms of religious liturgy, this prayer became so central, not because of anything that it has to do with. The subject matter is simply that God is great, but it's so beautifully written from a poetic perspective that it became very meaningful in rituals. And that's what I'm arguing, is that, you know, there is a beauty, an aesthetic beauty. There's a sense of identity that people get from religion, and then there's its literal message. And the literal message, for those of us who are interested in such things, can often disappoint.
You know, one thing I'll say about the Kaddish, that even, you know, if you're secular, if you see prayer as a chant as opposed mm-hmm. to a literal message, that
yep.
even though the chant of the mourner's prayer, Kaddish, is, mm-hmm. is just praising God.
Mm-hmm.
The chant aspect of it is so really profound and beautiful.
Yes.
So maybe it was always meant to be that way. Maybe it was never meant to be, you know, okay, this is the literal message you're taking away. Maybe it was more of a chant, in the way that chants and meditations can have meaning that is above and beyond the actual meaning of the words.
Well, I definitely agree that chanting and doing a number of different kinds of things, like meditation, can be wonderfully powerful and important for people in sort of getting outside of themselves, getting outside of their normal routine, and really experiencing their emotions, experiencing some, in the case of mourning, their grief, and experiencing life more fully. And so in the book, I talk about a number of ways in which, again, secularists, humanists, the non-religious can use some of these same techniques that emerged to be associated with religion, but really speak more to just broader human experience. Because I agree, you know, to have that experience can be incredibly powerful. But I would suggest that we can do better than simply rely only on the traditional sources that have this message that we no longer believe in.
One of the kind of standard questions that people turn to religion for is, why do we die? Why did my loved one die? Mm. Why are there massacres and genocides and the Holocaust? Like, what? Why is that? And, you know, different religions and different people within religions have come up with their answers. I mean, one of the answers is God works in mysterious ways, and
right.
we will never understand that.
Right.
And, you know, and everybody has heard many answers from you know, religious authorities about ways of addressing those questions. Obviously,
right.
the answers you heard
right.
from rabbis or maybe from priests as well and
mm-hmm.
Buddhist monks as well didn't
mm-hmm.
satisfy you. So I'd like you to explain a little bit why you felt unsatisfied by the answers you were getting to the really big questions from the worlds of religion.
Sure. I mean, and I talk in the book about a number of liberal religious thinkers who have a lot of intelligent things to say about so many important contemporary issues. And some of them will say things like, God is love, or God is the universe, or God is mystery. And if you think God is love, or God is the universe, then most likely you and I are going to agree on a lot of political issues, and we're going to be able to work together. But why do we need to use the word God when we have the perfectly good word love, or the universe? You know, I simply want to try to be as honest as I can be about what I'm talking about. And if you think God is mystery, well, mystery is not a great source of comfort in the face of death. You know, at least that I didn't find that mystery to be all that comforting when my father died or when I lost other loved ones. And what I was really wanting was not, you know, the presence of a mystery, but the presence of people to love me and care for me. And that's what I try to offer in the face of death to the members of my own community is the sense that, look, there is no justification for the tragedies that happen. There is no good reason that we could ever come up with for why the Holocaust happened, for why innocent children are ripped away from us every single day, every minute. There's nothing that one could say that would say, oh, this makes it better, you'll be rewarded in heaven. No, it's not sufficient. And what to me, the only thing that we can say is that we care, we love, we acknowledge death is real. It's final. It takes tremendous, tremendous courage to cope with. And we have to love one another because that's what we get. We get this world, this one shot.
So maybe this is the wrong question to end an interview with a humanist chaplain and rabbi, but what are you doing on Christmas Day?
I'll be getting together with my family. I've always enjoyed that day. When I grew up with this idea of Santa Claus, and I think that Santa Claus, by the way, is a great exercise for humanists to take their kids through because it presents us with this idea of a mythological being who has very important powers and cares if you're naughty or you're nice. And, you know, and you have to engage with that idea as a child. And then children are encouraged to question that idea over time and ask, is there really a Santa Claus? Is that really true? You know, that time of year really spoke to me as a child. And that's why I still feel a connection to it as a culturally Christian, culturally American holiday. I don't think there's anything wrong with celebrating the fact that we have this culture and this history in common as Americans and as people of the world. The question is, what do we believe about it? And how do we believe it, you know, we should go about trying to be good people? And that's the discussion that we have to have. But I think we can celebrate in many ways together.
Greg Epstein, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, Terry, it's a pleasure.
Greg Epstein is the humanist chaplain at Harvard University. His new book is called Good Without God. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the new book, Good Without God, my guest Greg Epstein writes that the fastest growing religious preference in America is non-religious. In his job as Harvard University's humanist chaplain, Epstein works with non-religious students. He describes the humanist community as a place where family, memory, ethical values, and the uplifting of the human spirit can come together with intellectual honesty and without a God. Today is a humanist holiday called Human Light, a secular alternative to the religious holidays of the season. It was created in 2001. Greg Epstein is a humanist rabbi. He has his M.A. in theological studies from the Harvard Divinity School. He wrote his new book in response to people who ask, how can you be good without God? Greg Epstein, welcome to Fresh Air. So today is a humanist holiday, December 23rd, called Human Light. Are you celebrating that? Do you recognize that holiday?
Yes, I recognize Human Light as one of the holidays that humanists celebrate at this time of year. I've written about it in the book. But I also think that there are many ways to celebrate this time of year, including celebrating the traditionally religious holidays from a cultural point of view. So in other words, I think that most humanists and atheists that are of a Christian cultural background like to celebrate Christmas from a Christian cultural point of view. Most humanists and atheists of a Jewish cultural background enjoy something about Hanukkah and about that tradition, but from a cultural point of view instead of viewing it as something about God and religion.
Can we mention that probably a lot of Jews give Christmas gifts too?
Yeah, because I think that you know, the America is a profoundly culturally Christian country in a way that it is not religiously Christian. And so it's not such a terrible thing or something that we need to run away from that our calendar and a lot of our national consciousness follows the rhythm of the traditionally Christian calendar. The positive part of that for me is that a lot of customs that have come from one or another aspect of Christianity have really been made very cultural and very secular and even very humanist in recent generations. And so to me, you know, the idea of Christmas, of giving gifts, it really has very, very, very little to do other than that little story about Jesus and him receiving gifts. It really has very little to do with the theology of Jesus Christ. Or even a theology about a God. What it has to do with, to me, is this idea that this is the time of year when it's darkest. This is the time of year for us here in North America when it's coldest. And seasonal affective disorder, sad, is real. And we do. We get a little sadder. We get a little bit more depressed at this time of year if we're not careful. And so we give gifts to one another to warm each other up. And I think that that's a wonderful thing to do and a very secular thing to do.
Let's talk a little bit about what you mean when you describe yourself as a humanist. Mm-hmm. In your book, you say humanism is a bold, resolute response to the fact that being a human being is lonely and frightening. And humanism means taking charge of the often lousy world around us and working to shape it into a better place, though we know we cannot ever finish the task. Can you talk a little bit more about what humanism means to you?
Well, humanism to me, it's been formally defined by the American Humanist Association, and it's a short definition that I think is helpful, a progressive life stance or a progressive philosophy of life that without supernaturalism, without anything magical or supernatural, affirms our ability and our responsibility to lead ethical lives of personal fulfillment, aspiring to the greater good of humanity. But in short, I would say that humanism is good without God. It is that struggle, that process of trying to live the best life that we possibly can for ourselves and for all human beings and for the sake of the natural world that surrounds us and that sustains us and that we've put in danger. That's good without God. That's humanism. But I guess I would also add to that the emphasis for me of humanism is not on the without God. It's not on what we disbelieve in. Everybody has something that they disbelieve in. You know, Christians disbelieve in Islam. Muslims disbelieve in Christianity. But to me, the emphasis of humanism is really on what we do believe. It's on the good and our pursuit of the good and our determination to be good with others and for others.
Let's talk about how you became a humanist, because you were really on your way to becoming more of a religion scholar, I think it's fair to say, but I'll ask you specifically about that a little later. But let's start with the fact that you grew up in New York and in Flushing, mm-hmm. Queens. You describe your parents as secular, disinterested Jews. Mm-hmm. Did they observe the High Holy Days? Because there's a lot of like secular Jews who on Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah will observe.
We did. We went to our local synagogue for those particular days because I think that, like other families, we were looking for some way to connect with what was clearly our heritage, what was clearly our culture. And it seemed that these were the days that were well known to be the most important days on the calendar. And so it was the sense that, well, at least we should go these days. Everybody's going these days. And nobody, quite frankly, or at least very few people, would go any other days besides those. And so we would show up in synagogue on those particular days, and not really knowing what to do. And when I would get there, I would observe the people around me, and they'd be cracking open these sort of musty older prayer books. And they would be reciting, at the very best, words that just seemed to be recited by rote. Baruch atah Adonai, blessed are you, O Lord, our God. But it didn't really seem to me to be a group of people truly interested in blessing the Lord, their God. It seemed to me that if that was what these people really believed, their behavior would be different.
So when you discovered humanistic Judaism, is that when you went back and got your master's in Judaic studies?
So I did. I enrolled in the rabbinic program. Sherwin Wein was somebody who came from being a Reform rabbi in the 1960s. He was a brilliant young Reform rabbi who was leading a congregation. And like many rabbis, he'd gone to rabbinical school with the open understanding between him and his faculty that he was a humanist. He said, I'm not religious, but I like working with communities. I like my culture. I like my heritage. So I want to work at doing this job. And they said, sure, fine, no problem. Half of our students are. And this is Hebrew Union College, the largest rabbinical seminary in the country. But after several years of doing this, he decided that he just didn't want any more to say prayers that he didn't believe. He didn't want to get up in front of his congregation and have it be about a performance. He really wanted to speak more honestly to them. And so he created a movement where one could celebrate one's cultural background, in his case, Judaism, while combining that with a totally honest, raw, brave form of humanism that was uncompromising intellectually.
The word dignity was very important to your mentor, Sherwin Wein. What did dignity mean to him?
I think that Sherwin was interested in pursuing, and I, in turn, am really passionate about pursuing a sense of purpose, a sense of meaning in life that is not bound by or determined by a belief in a higher power that assigns us. We acknowledge as humanists that there is no one single overarching purpose or meaning to our lives that's given to us, that's handed to us by the universe. But Sherwin was very much aware in the tradition of Camus and many others that we therefore have not just the freedom but also the responsibility to choose a meaning for our own lives and to struggle to pursue it. And, he simply asked these questions, well, what is the meaning of our life? What is the purpose of our life if not, avoiding divine punishment or achieving divine reward? And he called it dignity. It's this idea that we're never going to be happy all the time. I mean, the writer Tony Kushner once said that he's never met anyone who's perfectly happy all the time. The best you can do is happy-ish. But Sherwin and I would probably argue as well that happy-ish can be pretty good if combined with a sense of dignity, a sense that one is, and in this I would use again a saying that comes from religion but that has nothing to do with God, that one is for oneself, because if we're not for ourselves, who will be for us? But we are also for others, because if we're only for ourselves, what are we? And if not now, when? That's dignity to me, that sense that we build our lives and the meaning of our lives based on the relationships, the connections that we have with other people in the here and now.
So getting back to the idea of humanistic Judaism, you say you've preserved some of the aspects of Judaism.
Mm-hmm.
So do you do anything on Yom Kippur, which is one of the high holy days? It's a day of like atonement and fasting.
Sure. Yes, for me personally, I did fast for 24 hours, 25, 26 hours this past Yom Kippur as a way of reflecting on the meaning of my own life and on what kind of person I'd been in the year that had passed. I think that to me, again, it's this idea that religion had its good ideas and its bad ideas. And they've all evolved naturally. And one of the ideas that I think is helpful is to take some time throughout the year, throughout our lives, on a regular basis, to check in with ourselves and say, how are we doing? How am I doing? How am I living? How am I handling my relationships with the people that I care most about? How am I handling my relationship with this earth that I live on, that I can't do without? And, you know, these are ideas that don't come from religion. You don't need religion to have them. But religion is the thing in today's society that seems to embody or provide a structure for some of these things, because that's the way that they evolved. They came to us through religious traditions, because everything about human society used to be religious when we didn't have better answers for some of religion's questions.
Your humanist mentor, Sherwin Wine, said that the mistake of the Jewish Reform Movement mm-hmm. was to translate the prayers, the Hebrew prayers, from Hebrew to English. And he said once modern people could actually understand what they were supposed to be saying, big mistake. And so I want to talk with you a little bit about the mourner's prayer for the dead, the Kaddish. Mm-hmm. It's called Kaddish. And
sure.
I don't speak Hebrew, so I can't translate it word for word, but just listening to the sounds of the words in Hebrew and the
yes.
way that those sounds are chanted, I think it is mm-hmm. one of the most beautiful prayers I've ever heard. And it is one of the most rhythmic prayers
yes.
that I know, and almost really contemporary in its rhythm, too, and in the musicality of that rhythm.
Timeless, in fact.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I always wonder, well, what is it saying? What does it mean?
Mm-hmm.
Because you kind of give it your own meaning when you don't really know the literal translation.
Sure.
So I thought I'd read a translation, unless you can translate it. Could you just translate what the
words
are?
I would say that Yitgadal v'Yitgadash Shemei Rabbah, may it be magnified and sanctified, his great name, God's great name. And that's exactly what the Mourner's Kaddish is about. It's such a beautiful composition, and based on my study of the Hebrew liturgy, and I had a chance in my studies to study many different forms of religious liturgy, that this prayer became so central, not because of anything that it has to do with. The subject matter is simply that God is great, but it's so beautifully written from a poetic perspective that it became very meaningful in rituals. And that's what I'm arguing, is that, you know, there is a beauty, an aesthetic beauty. There's a sense of identity that people get from religion, and then there's its literal message. And the literal message, for those of us who are interested in such things, can often disappoint.
You know, one thing I'll say about the Kaddish, that even, you know, if you're secular, if you see prayer as a chant as opposed mm-hmm. to a literal message, that
yep.
even though the chant of the Mourner's Prayer, Kaddish, is just praising God.
Mm-hmm.
The chant aspect of it is so really profound and beautiful.
Yes.
So maybe it was always meant to be that way. Maybe it was never meant to be, you know, okay, this is the literal message you're taking away. Maybe it was more of a chant, in the way that chants and meditations can have meaning that is above and beyond the actual meaning of the words.
Well, I definitely agree that chanting and doing a number of different kinds of things, like meditation, can be wonderfully powerful and important for people in sort of getting outside of themselves, getting outside of their normal routine, and really experiencing their emotions, experiencing some, in the case of mourning, their grief, and experiencing life more fully. And so in the book, I talk about a number of ways in which, again, secularists, humanists, the non-religious, can use some of these same techniques that emerged to be associated with religion, but really speak more to just broader human experience. Because I agree, you know, to have that experience can be incredibly powerful. But I would suggest that we can do better than simply rely only on the traditional sources that have this message that we no longer believe in.
One of the kind of standard questions that people turn to religion for is, why do we die? Why did my loved one die?
Mm.
Why are there massacres and genocides and the Holocaust? Like, why is that?
Yeah.
And, you know, different religions and different people within religions have come up with their answers. I mean, one of the answers is God works in mysterious ways, and
right.
we will never understand that.
Right.
And, you know, and everybody has heard many answers from you know, religious authorities about ways of addressing those questions. Obviously,
right.
the answers you heard
right.
From rabbis or maybe from priests as well and
mm-hmm.
Buddhist monks as well didn't
mm-hmm.
satisfy you. So I'd like you to explain a little bit why you felt unsatisfied by the answers you were getting to the really big questions from the worlds of religion.
Sure. I mean, and I talk in the book about a number of liberal religious thinkers who have a lot of intelligent things to say about so many important contemporary issues. And some of them will say things like God is love or God is the universe or God is mystery. And if you think God is love or God is the universe, then most likely you and I are going to agree on a lot of political issues and we're going to be able to work together. But why do we need to use the word God when we have the perfectly good word love or the universe? You know, I simply want to try to be as honest as I can be about what I'm talking about. And if you think God is mystery, well, mystery is not a great source of comfort in the face of death. You know, at least that I didn't find that mystery to be all that comforting when my father died or when I lost other loved ones. And what I was really wanting was not, you know, the presence of a mystery, but the presence of people to love me and care for me. And that's what I try to offer in the face of death to the members of my own community is the sense that, look, there is no justification for the tragedies that happen. There is no good reason that we could ever come up with for why the Holocaust happened, for why innocent children are ripped away from us every single day, every minute. There's nothing that one could say that would say, oh, this makes it better, you'll be rewarded in heaven. No, it's not sufficient. And what to me, the only thing that we can say is that we care, we love, we acknowledge death is real. It's final. It takes tremendous, tremendous courage to cope with. And we have to love one another because that's what we get. We get this world, this one shot.
So maybe this is the wrong question to end an interview with a humanist chaplain and rabbi, but what are you doing on Christmas Day?
I'll be getting together with my family. I've always enjoyed that day. I grew up with this idea of Santa Claus. And I think that Santa Claus, by the way, is a great exercise for humanists to take their kids through because it presents us with this idea of a mythological being who has very important powers and cares if you're naughty or you're nice. And, you know, and you have to engage with that idea as a child. And then children are encouraged to question that idea over time and ask, is there really a Santa Claus? Is that really true? And you know, that time of year really spoke to me as a child. And that's why I still feel a connection to it as a culturally Christian, culturally American holiday. I don't think there's anything wrong with celebrating the fact that we have this culture and this history in common as Americans and as people of the world. The question is, what do we believe about it? And how do we believe we should go about trying to be good people? And that's the discussion that we have to have. But I think we can celebrate in many ways together.
Greg Epstein, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, Terry, it's a pleasure.
Greg Epstein is the humanist chaplain at Harvard University. His new book is called Good Without God. This week, our critics are looking back on 2009. Book critic Maureen Corrigan is here to talk about the books on her 10 best list.
This was a major year for looking back to the Great Depression for guidance, as well as for a buck-up dose of that era's shining-through Shirley Temple spirit. Out of all the 30s-themed books I read this year, my pick for the best nonfiction book is Kirsten Downey's biography of Frances Perkins called The Woman Behind the New Deal. Here's how Franklin Roosevelt's controversial choice for Secretary of Labor recalled the first meeting of FDR's cabinet in 1933. I tried to have as much of a mask as possible. I wanted to give the impression of being a quiet, orderly woman who didn't buzz all the time. You didn't butt in with bright ideas. As Downey's compelling biography reveals, Perkins' strategy of reticence worked. She achieved many of her bright ideas, like the minimum wage, work hour limitations, and the Social Security Act. Indeed, if Perkins had completely realized her vision, national health care would have long been an American reality. Henry Ford, of course, was a bitter foe of FDR and his worker-friendly legislation. During the 1930s, Ford poured money and manpower into a Disneyland-type settlement in the Amazon called Fordlandia. In a lively work of narrative history of the same title, historian Greg Grandin rediscovers this forgotten utopian town, the ruins of which still stand deep in the jungles of Brazil. Grandin mentions that Fordlandia had a dance hall where only polkas and minuets were allowed, since Ford disapproved of the sex dancing that was sweeping America in the 1920s and 30s. In contrast, esteemed literary critic Morris Dickstein's cultural history of the 1930s, called Dancing in the Dark, is fascinated with Busby Berkeley's sex dancing extravaganzas. Dickstein also investigates the deeper meanings of Art Deco industrial design, gangster movies, and the novels of Zora Neale Hurston and John Steinbeck. Finally, the work of nonfiction I reviewed this year that garnered the most listener response had nothing to do with the Great Depression. Happens Every Day by novice writer Isabel Gillies is a disarming memoir that focuses on the collapse of her marriage to a poetry professor at Oberlin, a school, Gillies tells us, where all the students play an instrument well and know how to address transgendered people. Any year in which I stumble upon a terrific new mystery series is a bull market year for me. This past summer, a wise independent bookseller recommended that I read the Mo Prager mysteries set in Brooklyn and starring a Jewish former police detective. The atmospheric Prager series is written by Reed Farrell Coleman, who just may be the only mystery writer licensed to drive trucks filled with hazardous materials like nuclear waste. Speaking of nuclear Armageddon, my nominee for this year's Best Work of Literary Fiction, Zoe Heller's acerbic novel of ideas, The Believers, merrily decimates the world its characters once inhabited. The Believers explores what happens when a zealous, William Kunstler-type superstar lawyer dies and his children drift into various other political and religious orthodoxies. Heller has no patience with what she calls the phenomenon of relatability in fiction. Her characters aren't particularly likable. Instead, they rivet our attention with their wit, smarts, and bad behavior. Other fiction standouts were the incomparable Laurie Moore's seductive tale, A Gate at the Stairs, her first novel in 15 years, Brooklyn by Colm Tobin, about a young Irish woman who immigrates to New York in the 1950s and works at a department store, and The Man in the Wooden Hat by British master Jane Gardam. This nuanced story of a long marriage is a companion piece to her best-known work, Old Filth. Last, but definitely not least, there's Jess Walter's superb farce, The Financial Lives of the Poets. His anti-hero is a middle-aged former journalist whose wife is on the verge of an affair and whose house is a week away from foreclosure. Unable to sleep one night, this sad sack goes out to a 7-Eleven to buy milk for his kid's cereal. There, he falls in with a gang of teenage drug dealers and hatches a desperate plan for restoring his financial solvency. It's not exactly a Frank Capra plot, but the screwball sensibility of Walter's novel is very much an updated take on those dark depression comedies. Here's to looking ahead to better times and many more terrific books.
Maureen Carrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. You can read excerpts of all the books on Maureen's list on our website, freshair.npr.org.